Okay. That's good.
Good. Believe it or not, the Army thought we could keep this thing secret. So they put a secrecy label on everything, including a volume that I and others helped put together. And it wasn't until about 5 years went by that we persuaded them to make this thing public. This way we could get patents on the various ideas involved. And that's where publication comes in the Electrochemical Society, for example. At that time, I had a bunch of chemists working for me, or metallurgists, who could only, and they were working with physicists generally, occasionally an electrical engineer who were designing semiconductor devices. And every time they had any kind of a new idea that they tried out in small scale, they were publishing it in the American Physical Society publications.
Mm-hmm.
Because the principal team member was generally a physicist. And it was a journal that was not read by other chemists and other metallurgists. And they were unhappy about it, publishing in these vague journals.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in phys reviews, new ideas would come out, you know, quick. And the patent department was very interested in having us do this to beat other people to the punch. That's where people were all over the country who were in, and the new Japanese who came in at that time and bought licenses from the Western Electric Company to use our patents. So I had to do something about this, and that's where I met with the president of the American Institute of Electrical Engineers and the president of the Electrochemical Society.
Who was that?
I don't remember his name, but he was R.M. Burns ran this as almost his private publication for years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who took his place, but whoever it was, I met with him and I was going to propose the Electrochemical Society as probably the best place for my people to publish in. I wasn't thinking of starting an electrochemical division for the society. That developed.
Mm-hmm.
The American Chemical Society was a respected old society, many divisions, you know, tremendous. They talked, they're in the 60,000 or so, whatever it is. I don't know what it is today.
150.
Is that what it is? Yeah. I have all our insurance policies, by the way, everything. I've been in 56 years, I've been a member of the. There's a CNE News, you know?
Yes, yeah.
So I look at all. Anyway, the metallurgical people had one of the principal people I had involved was in the Metallurgical Society. He tried to get their publication to be the one that would be the flagship for the process activity. There's a lot of processing in semiconductors, a lot of etching, a lot of plating, a lot of deposition of oxides, for example, from gaseous mixtures of various sorts. And, you know, the ratio of designers of solid-state devices to people who make them, the chemists, the metallurgists, is about 8 to 1. Because one designer can keep 8 process people busy.
Mm-hmm.
Building all the various pieces of equipment that had to be built, things of that sort, mm-hmm. and new ideas. But anyway, I conceived the idea and sold it with a little foot dragging on the part of some of the other societies. IEEE wanted to handle it. And I said, there ain't no history in this business. And they were compartmentalized too. They had people interested in batteries, but only because of power. They weren't interested in low power batteries and things like that, or even solar cells, which some of our public relations guys inadvertently call them batteries, you know. I used to get on to a town nearby to get my hair cut at noon. The barber says, how's your battery doing? I said, what is this guy know about my battery for? and I was doing fine. Next time when Donnie asked me again, I said, look, he asked me that a month ago. Why are you interested in the battery in my car? Oh, no, I'm interested in the battery in your car. You're from Bell Laboratories, aren't you? Yes, yes. They have invented a new battery. Oh, I said, that isn't a battery. That's a public relations guy's called that. It's a photocell. It's a PN junction, which when exposed to sunlight generates electrons. And sure, you might call that a battery, but it's not. That's what he was trying to be nice, show that he knew about Bell Laboratories and Barber, you know.
Yeah.
Talking to people. So,
where did your own connection to the Electrochemical Society begin? Is that through R.M. Burns?
No, it wasn't, surprisingly. I should have done that, perhaps. I went to one of their meetings. Some of my people were publishing papers in it because they were members.
Papers on what sort of stuff?
Well, on solutions to selectively etch, for example, trenches of a certain size and width and things of this sort, and electroplating, contacts on things of this sort. So I met some of the leaders, I don't know who they were at the time, had lunch with them, and said, I'm proposing to our people that they publish all their papers in the Electrochemical Society journals and present them in Electrochemical Society meetings. And how do you react to that? Would you be welcome? And well, they had to think about it for a little while. So in the afternoon, they called me somewhere on the hall. They said they talked about it. And they said it was a pretty good idea. And would I help organize it? And I said, would. I just want to tell you one thing. I'm not a member of this society. Oh, you're not. We thought you were. Well, we'll take care of that right away. So they... I don't know, I wrote a check out or something for whatever the fee was. I became a member of the society.
This was in about what year?
Oh. I would say this is in the early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while I attended a lot of their meetings. And I chaired some of them.
Now they hadn't got a division at this time for solid state.
No, that's right. Then I found I was spending more of my time in the halls talking to people and worrying about is the projector for that meeting there or not, you know? Did so-and-so arrive or not? I wouldn't attend any of the papers. I was in the hallway. I said, this isn't for me. It's a waste of my time. So I sort of left the society at that point. I got involved in other things, you see.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
I kept the journals coming for years. I hated to throw them out. In fact, I had such a collection of them that I tried to give them away to small universities and they didn't want them. Finally, I found out that the Chinese would take them for their universities. The only catch was I'd have to pay to ship them there, box them up, and apply for an import license. You better give me a hard time. I'm trying to do this, so I told them, you know, run up a tree. I finally threw them away. Nobody wanted them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they were old journals, but this would be great for people who are starved for material.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't supply it with the dates. I have. I'm on page. Where am I here? I try to put dates down. I call various people. Like for example, I have Paris tubes down there. Before I left the tube business, the military, when the Germans left Paris, they took the tubes out, the switching tubes out of the exchanges. Not all of them, but enough of them, so they weren't operable. Well, they flew those over to the U.S. Believe it or not. And I was called in one morning to talk to someone in the what do you call that department? Down in the people who deal with signal department, I guess it's called. They wanted us to make a couple of hundred tubes, all necessary, and they had three samples of three different kinds of tubes. We looked them over and we decided, well, I think we can do this, but it'll take us at least 36 hours. Can't you do it faster? You know, we want to get the exchange and all that. So we brought some cots in, had the cafeteria across the street, bring over stuff to eat, and we worked right through around the clock for about 24 hours. One fellow was, first of all, the electronics guys had to test the tubes to find out what their performance was like. And then the mechanical guys, we took them apart. We measured the thickness of everything. And by God, we sent those tubes back in less than 30 hours. And we never heard from them, so they must be working. You think they let us know, you know. Never told us. If we thought they let us know if they're not working. The Germans expected to be back, see?
Yeah.
That's why they took the tubes out. They didn't want to destroy the exchange. Mm-hmm. They really thought they were going to get back, I suppose.
Hmm.
Well, I should have turned that page there.
Yeah. The, can we just talk about...
Yeah, here's ASTM here. Hmm. You lead the question.
The creation of solid-state activity within the Electrochemical Society. I mean, that's...
As I recall, for the time I was with them, they were concerned mostly with process problems, as I say. We had a lot of etching to do. The way you etch a design into silicon or germanium beforehand, you coat it with an oxide of the silicon or the germanium, or you put sometimes silicon dioxide on germanium, and then through a photo process, you put a photoresist on it, and by a photo you impress a design,
mm-hmm.
and then you put it in acids, and you etch out where the photoresist has not been activated by the light, and that's the way. Now this is no longer physicists. Now these are at in those early days, we made our own photoresists before we got Eastman Kodak involved in the thing. And they became the principal supplier, but it took them 5 years to crank up speed. In the meantime, we had photoresists that were better than other people's photoresists. Other people had techniques for etching that were better than our techniques. And after they patented these things, it would be nice to share these things amongst one another, you know. But the Electrochemical Society, as I recall, was not very much involved in growing single crystal silicon or single crystal germanium before then. Or that was all done in the Bell Laboratory, and I don't know where they published that work, because I wasn't involved in that aspect of it. The metallurgist had to across the street in another building. I was more involved in, once the silicon was grown, how you slice it, how you oxidize it, how you impress a pattern on it, how you etch that pattern, how do you make contacts on that pattern, and how do you encapsulate it, how do you wash it. We had to install the first clean room in the industry, because tiny amounts of sodium had a tremendous effect on linkage between very tiny lines that were tenths of mils apart.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to develop pure water. I had to work with the water people. And deionized water wasn't good enough. We had to get water that was like... We developed a water that was so pure that the particular young PhD who did this wasn't in his room one day when I brought two visitors in and explained what was going on in there. And the next day, I called him to say... And before I could get very far, he said, "Yeah, I can tell you and two other people were in my laboratory yesterday." How could you tell? Well, you're all breathing out carbon dioxide. Carbonic acid was forming in my water and it registered on my meters. That's how pure that water was. You see, he could tell me how many people were. This is the guy who invented that duck that dips in the water and goes, "John, he invented that." Never made a nickel of it. He sold it to some toy company who made a mint value for it. Miles Sullivan, I still remember him.
Miles?
Sullivan.
Sullivan. Mm-hmm. So the Electrochemical Society would be where this all this sort of stuff was then being published. That's this true. Process.
Yeah, the stuff that was mostly electrochemical in nature, and you know, I really didn't appreciate it. And as older I get, I think about it. Electrochemistry is a part of chemistry that the usual inorganic chemical group has it over in some sidebar, you know, not but. But if you think about it today, with the tremendous plant we have around the country and bridges and highways, a little bit of electrochemistry with a little bit of electronics engineering generate DC currents, feed them in back. You could prevent corrosion of all this stuff that has to rust, be scraped and painted, and then finally replaced with electrochemistry. I tried to sell this idea to a man who was on the Federal Commission on Bridges. And he was polite about the thing, but he wasn't going to recommend any large effort spending money to develop these techniques. But you see, the small electrochemical circuits are generated. That's called corrosion.
Yeah.
And if you can buck it by putting another thing, you can do that with photocells and some circuitry, no moving parts.
Yeah.
But somebody has to develop this industry. It's still laying there, undeveloped.
Yeah.
That's just one example.
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure there are tremendous examples of electrochemistry in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
With microcurrents, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure that, you know, 50 years from now, we're going to have replacement parts in the way of chips in the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Somebody has to do this, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry to tell you that, you know, I didn't wave a flag saying, you know, I'm the guy who put this into the Electrochemical Society and they organized a division and it's going very well. I dropped out because I'd solved my problem. I had found an outlet for my people.
Yeah. Were you actually engaged in the organization of the division in the Electrochemical Society or not?
No.
No.
After I found myself wandering around the hall and not getting involved, I figured I'd done my job.
Yeah.
Just as I did with ASTM.
Yeah.
I'd done my job and got on to other things.
Yeah.
I had more problems to solve than I had time, so I had no time for the luxury of getting associated with the society and getting to be its vice president or president and going to meetings and giving talks. That wasn't my job. I had, back home at the Bell Laboratories, I had things to sell. I was being promoted. I became a department head and I became a director. By the time I retired, I had 400 people working in, Murray Hill, Homedale, Whippany, Allentown, Reading, Boston, Cincinnati, Kansas City. That's where I had people. I spent my last 5 or 10 years in an airplane running around and talking to people, listening to what they were doing, and coming back home and trying to sell my management for money and support and things of this sort. I was a manager, technical manager.
Yeah.
Hiring people, firing people where necessary, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Dennis, for example, Dennis Turner, he was more or less of a fundamental chemist when I met him. I brought him over and put him into this applied chemical group that I called it. And I gave him the job to design in these little tiny plugs that go into the back of telephone. You've seen those?
Mm-hmm.
They're little gold-plated wires.
Mm-hmm.
The Washington Electric Company decided they didn't know about gold-plating. And this was being made in some place out in Idaho. They had 7 subcontractors they had gone through who couldn't produce a plated spring wire that didn't have holes in the plating, so it corroded. Didn't meet the Bell Lab specification, which was if we did it in a lab, we produced gold without pores in it, without holes in it. So the substrate metal, which was a spring wire, didn't corrode and come through and oxidize and become an insulator instead of the connector. Well, I told Dennis, why don't you build a machine? I'll get you the money that you can make this to meet all their requirements. They don't have to go out for 6 subcontractors. They can do it all themselves. The last thing I did before I retired, Dennis delivered this machine to a Western Electric plant in Idaho, and a manager called me up. He says, I know you're retired, but I want to say this is the first machine we ever bought from anybody that worked after we plugged it in. As far as I know, that machine is still running. Dennis had never done anything like this before. He had to build all the facility, and he applied his mind as a scientist to it. He not only built the machinery in its physical form, but he also built the techniques for analyzing all the solutions and adding to it whatever it needed, anything to be added to it. And I had a whole bunch of circuits in a cabinet that stood 6 feet high. It's a great job.
Mm-hmm.
It never would have been done by a chemist all alone in a laboratory.
Yeah.
He has to have circuit designers help him. I had all those people, you see, in various parts of my organization.
Yeah. How your own, as your own career went on, the transistor was how central to your career?
Well, it was everything, as a matter of fact. It sort of pushed everything aside, especially in its early days when their reliability was at very low ebbs. And it was because of these, I had to persuade these hard-headed electrical engineers that this was because of contamination was getting in. You were getting leakage fast. You needed to wash these things in very pure water as a last step. And you had to put them together in rooms that didn't have a million particles per cubic foot, like this room here. I bet it's 2 million particles right there. You don't see it. We developed. I had a young engineer working for me that I borrowed from Sandia. We had to run the Sandia labs for the government. I brought him into Murray Hill and supported him. And he's the fellow who developed the HEPA filters that allowed us to filter this air. I can't even remember his name because he went back. I tell you what happened. We were subcontracting, or Sandia was subcontracting, to build the can't think of the name of the gear. Was it navigational gear used by the Air Force and the Navy in some place up in Syracuse, New York, I think it was. Yep. And they had learned up there that they had to scrub all these particles out of the air, and people had to suit up and let the clothes, you know, see them in, because the dirtiest thing in a room was a person, you know. And this young fella worked with one of the, his idea was we would outfit a couple of large moving trucks with benches and filters and fans to bring air in and clean them and bring water up from the tanks that we had and purify them. So when we got contractor A, who might only last for a year, we take this moving van up to his place and move it up the back of his plant, open up a door, and he rented. When the contract was over, we shut the door, got a truck up, and we hauled it away, that van to the succeeding contractor. We didn't have to wait for him to build new rooms all the time and teach him all the experience.
Mm-hmm.
We moved it with a job, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I thought it was a good idea, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I used that in a hospital there. In deep hip surgery, the amount, you know, it's about a 6-hour job in these dirty rooms with these surgeons spitting in the wounds because they have masks on, but they're sodden, you know. I went over to England where one of our licensees was there. I had talked to them 5 years earlier about HEPA filters. One of the people I talked to had a brother who was a surgeon in hip surgery, and he had installed these in England. By the way, the surgeons in England are dressed as Mr., mm-hmm. not a doctor. And he had reduced the rate of having to reopen them because of problems with the raw materials that had gotten in from the air, down from 7% down to 2.5%. So I sent a surgeon over from New Jersey to find out what he was doing. Paid his way. He came back, and I said, well, we're going to put a room like that in here. He said, no, I'm the head man of this department. No, I said, you don't realize I'm the chief executive officer of this hospital. You're going to do what I tell you. I put in a HEPA filter room in Orange, New Jersey, and I put them in gowns with a umbilical cord on the back, so we brought air conditioned air in and took it out. And they didn't sweat, didn't have to spit, you know, masks on. We put X's on the floor where they were allowed to stand, because they couldn't have the air washing over them, because they were the dirtiest things in the room, even with this, with all this equipment on. And we got the same, down some down 3%. It was from 12% to 3%.
Mm-hmm.
When I went out of office 4 years later, you know, they closed that room. This guy was still there. He was going to have some non-physician tell him what to do. Would you believe that? Terrible. I guess it's hard to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I had sent people from the Bell Labs down there to help them design this room and to advise them what to buy and things of this sort. You know, I was always doing five things at one time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
While I was running a baseball team. Or being the mayor of the town, and things like that. You know? So I had a sort of a fractured existence, running from one thing to the next, and not getting any understanding of things except what people told me. I had to depend on them, see? I couldn't do it with my own hands. These weren't my own numbers, you know. They were their numbers, you know. And I had to depend on people. So I was careful to hire what I thought were good people. And some of them are still there. As a matter of fact, the last guy I hired, I found out, see if I can get his picture here. This is, you know, the Bell Labs is being broken up into two pieces now.
Yes.
And see if I picked out the right one. Yeah, here he is. Joe Abbott, Technical Manager, Electroplating Development, Advanced Lightweight Products, Research Marie Hill, was awarded the D. Gardner Folk Memorial Award by the Metropolitan New York Section of the Electrochemical Society. He was the last guy on earth.
Very good.
PhD. I don't know what he did to this particular one. You know,
when you look at transistor development over time, how important was the Electrochemical Society as a forum for discussion
well,
development? Was it the most important place?
As I understand it, first of all, it depends important to who.
Yeah.
It was certainly important to the people doing the work. They were published in a journal that their peers would read,
mm-hmm.
not in a physics society journal that their peers didn't even know about. That was an important thing to them. Obviously, these were key techniques, and they're still used today. And as a matter of fact, these techniques are what limits the absolute growth to finer and finer dimensions. They're thinking of getting down into the angstrom area and try to do the thing. I'll admit to you that I've been I was preaching for the last 5 years there. We're going to try to get all the wet chemistry out of transistor processing. Do it all in gases,
mm-hmm.
ionized gases, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who made the transistors, especially in the factories, they love that. Because the cost of these chemicals. Now, for example, I was on the committee at Bell Labs on the environment, and the last thing I did before I retired, I shoved across a requirement that manufacturing engineers have to include in their cost of product the cost of protecting the environment from the outfall of their products. Like, for example, hydrochloric acid used in the Allentown plant by the ton was bought by overhead, like they buy water. It wasn't assigned to any particular product. This time when a fellow put in an etching process that required hydrochloric acid, he not only paid for the acid, but he paid to neutralize the acid. And they weren't very happy with it. But it's the only honest way to do it.
Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how much the hydrochloric acid dropped down in use. They found other things that worked just as well. It didn't have the problem of reclaiming them or neutralizing them, things of this sort. That's when gases began to make their presence felt. Take a gas and ionize it. It's very clean. And it can etch real fast. And you don't have to worry about liquids. You don't have to worry about people breathing because all this is inside glass chambers. And you see, you take all these roads. You've got to be careful not to have too much loyalty to one group because you might find yourself, as you understand it, that you have to obsolesce that group and get over in another with another technology.
Yeah.
You've got to have new people looking in to find out what's wrong with what you're doing today. What would be a better way to do it? That was my constant source of preaching, you know, to stimulate you. Don't sit back and say you know how to do it. Not good enough. You know how to do it better and cheaper and more reliable, more effective.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my role. You can see it's an oddball. I was an oddball to start with in this sort of organization. But I flitted around amongst these things, and I did very well for myself and the people involved.
Mm. Mm.
Batteries. No, I was involved in fuel cells. You're familiar with fuel cells?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, in the landing on the moon, they were going to rely on fuel cells. And we had a bunch of people down in Washington consulting with NASA, and Ian Ross was down there. He was president of this subgroup. He finally came back to Bell Labs, and he was my boss at that time. He called me from Washington and said, "We don't know whether we can do the moon job because we're not sure the fuel cells are going to work. We have three subcontractors, and we get all kind of mixed signals. We may have to scrub it. Would you get a committee together of senior people, go out and talk to these three suppliers, and let us know what you think?" I did this, and of course we had a very short fuse on this. We had to do this all in about 2-3 weeks. We made a recommendation, and I'll show you in the history what they said about that. I think I have it here. This is a book on the history of engineering and science of the Bell system. This is so. Here's the. It says here. Let me see. Bell Labs on occasion assisted in valuing the status of technical developments. For example, both the Gemini and Apollo programs, internal power. The spacecraft was supplied by fuel cells utilizing gases, hydrogen, and oxygen. Relatively new and unproven technology. By mid-1963, there was concern that none of the three commercial contractors carrying out the development would come through in time, thus seriously delaying flight schedules. Three specialists from Bell Labs, myself, Bruce Hannay, who later became a vice president, Upton Thomas, who was an old Electrochemical Society guy from day one. I think he was born in the society. He was always at Electrochemicals, was in it. And it says here, agreed to survey the different developments related to their conclusion. In late 63, they reported favorably on the prospect for success on one of them. That isn't in here. They were, as it turned out, correct. How's that? That means I didn't believe it. here's Ian Ross, who's my boy. They were working on it. Oh, by the way, here was the thing on, while they disclaimed any credit for the Manhattan Project here, It says here, samples of the Bell Labs material was being checked weekly by test labs at Columbia and Kellogg's. The process was due primarily to F.J. Biondi with contribution later by Ed Tolman. It says here, more than 36 years later, the Bell Lab process is still the process chosen for fabricating the long-life, reliable barrier material, not only at Oak Ridge, but also at Paducah, Kentucky, and Portsmouth, in the Hoya plants, and also at the Savannah River plant. That is a gold mm-hmm. process. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are newer ways of doing it now, centrifuges and things of this sort we couldn't use because we didn't have alloys strong enough to take the high. Yeah, here it is. Right here. I told how I got involved here, you know. That Bell Labs experimental work with the Manhattan Bridge Party began in an oblique way early in 1939, blah, blah, blah. Shockley and Nix were studying order-disorder phenomena. Mm-hmm. Where many Bell Labs staff members were pursuing graduate degrees. Under Bell Labs sponsorship, a fertile team of physicists, including Fermi, Dunning, and Pegram, involved experiments in neutron collisions. In the Columbia Chemistry Department, H.C. Urey had concentrated deuterium. He was a heavy water guy. Shockley and Nix visited Columbia to seek advice in the use of neutrons in their order disorder studies. At that time, 1939, they learned of early experiments of U-235. Well, it goes. It says here that Nix formed a small group, including Don McNair, George Clement, Larson. He was the only member of staff. Then I came in, and I didn't want to go to New Jersey, and he left. Mm-hmm. And it goes on to talk about the mixtures of helium and carbon dioxide. This is the only history there is that I can find anywhere where Bell Labs did today.
Yeah. Yes, that's the history of the engineering of science in the Bell system, and you're just reading from pages 348 and 9, which has a pretty good account.
Yeah, I don't know whether you can get this in a public library.
Yes, I think we have
have
a copy of that it was published in 78.
Yeah. So there it is.
Very good. You mentioned Bruce Hannay, and did your and his paths overlap a lot? I guess they must have done.
Yeah, well, Bruce, when he first came to Bell Labs, he was in a group with that was studying the corrosivity of the barrier that I had developed.
Excuse me, would you like a glass of iced tea?
That would be very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, we were worried about would it plug. Nickel is not supposed to plug, but you don't think not supposed to. You actually make tests. So he was running these tests out at Murray Hill. And much later, many years later, he's a fellow named Coleman, who also was an electrochemist. He was a real scientist. Both these fellows were trained as scientists. And he, Bruce Hannay brought the first mass spectrometer into the Bell Laboratory. Mm-hmm. And guess where he put it? He put it in a room next to where I had an office, where I was doing this secret work, had to bring people through it. And in a room on this side, there were three women with geodetic survey maps. They were laying out a horizon-to-horizon hilltop survey from Manhattan to Boston for the first microwave links. Mm. And later on, the first tube they used in that system was this one here, the 416 microwave amplifier. Mm-hmm. This is the first transistor here, the first 1,000-bit memory. You know, as I said, I had five or six books that I got from my Allentown group.
This I like your weak points.
Well, this is the 416 microwave amplifier. This is a traveling wave to a microwave amplifier, also used in many of the the government people. Now, this is a nickel cadmium tube, a nickel cadmium battery, which has a life of 10 years compared to the normal life, which is like 3 years, mm-hmm. that they used in the Moon Project. You notice they had ceramic seals rather than plastic seals. That's hermetically sealed. They could be like a tube is, This is the first transistor, which is a point contact on germanium. This is the first amplifier tube buried in the transatlantic cable. This is some of my early activity in creosote wood. That only lasted a year in that job. I discovered penicillin on that job a year before it was announced by a doctor in Canada. He discovered it the same way I did. I was trying to keep successive generations of various fungi alive, and I was losing 20% of my samples. And I looked in the petri dishes, and I could see the little dots. And I went to the man and said, "Hey, this is something is so powerful here that a fungus that would dissolve, eat up a cubic centimeter of wood in a week is killed." They said, "Look, we're in a trouble business. Never mind that medical stuff." And a year later, Sir Arthur Fleming, he was knighted by the Queen. He was the Queen or the King at that time. 1936.
He was the King, Alexander Fleming.
Yeah. Is no one good?
No, but I know about his work, yes.
He was a Nobelist.
Yes.
I wrote him a letter, told him how I discovered it. He wrote back, and he was very nice. Wrote back and said he discovered it the very same way. Too bad your people didn't pay any attention to you. But I didn't last very long in that job because this people in this lab were on the metric system. They used cubic centimeters of wood, and they told it how many grams of impregnate they put in, and then they had to transfer all this knowledge to an engineering group down in Louisiana where they pumped creosote in and stuff like that. And they were engineers, and they wanted to know pounds per. So the first job I had was to sit down at a machine with a handle and multiply these numbers by some other number to get it from grams per cubic centimeter to pounds per cubic foot.
Yes, yes.
And I worked the thing backwards and found out that something was wrong. This is, this. Mm-hmm. Let me book it out.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. If it's not sweet enough, let me know.
I brew my own tea and I make it strong.
That's good.
My maternal grandmother was English.
Okay.
Brewing tea was
an important activity.
Life.
Yes.
Well, I went into the.